third chapter. Chapter is called Divine Divinity and Divine Service. Sutta Uvacha. Yam Pavajan Tham Upetam Apeta Kutyam Ayano Viraha Katra Juhava Utreditam Mat Yatyata Taro Vavinedus Samsara Bhutta Yayam Munim Manantushmi. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Sutta Goswami said, "Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto that great sage, Shukadeva Goswami, who can enter the hearts of all. When he went away to take up the renounced order of life, sannyas, leaving home without undergoing reformation by the sacred thread or the ceremonies observed by the higher castes, his father Vyasadeva, fearing separation from him, cried out, 'O my son, indeed, only the trees, which were absorbed in the same feelings of separation, echoed in response to the bereaved father, purport, by Srila Prabhupada. The institution of Varna and Ashram prescribes many regulated duties to be observed by its followers. Such duties enjoin that the candidate willing to study the Vedas must approach a bona fide spiritual master and request acceptance as his disciple. The sacred thread is the sign for those who are competent to study the Vedas from the Acharya or the bona fide spiritual master. Sri Shukadeva Goswami did not undergo such purificatory ceremonies because he was liberated. He was a liberated soul from his very birth. Generally, man is born as an ordinary being and by the purificatory processes. He is born for the second time. When he sees a new light and seeks direction for spiritual progress, he approaches the spiritual master for instruction in Vedas. The spiritual master accepts only the sincere inquirer as his disciple and gives him the sacred thread. In this way, a man becomes twice born, or Dvija. After qualifying as a Dvija, one may study the Vedas, and after becoming well-versed in the Vedas, one becomes a Vipra. A Vipra, or a qualified Brahman, thus realizes the absolute truth and makes further progress in spiritual life until he reaches the Vaishnava stage. The Vaishnava stage is the postgraduate status of a Brahman. A progressive Brahman must necessarily become a Vaishnava, for a Vaishnava is a self-realized, learned Brahman. Srila Sukadeva Goswami was a Vaishnava from the beginning. Therefore, there was no need for him to undergo all the processes of the Varnashram institution. Ultimately, the aim of Varnashram Dharma is to turn a crude man into a pure devotee of the Lord or a Vaishnava. Anyone, therefore, who becomes a Vaishnava, accepted by the first-class Vaishnava, or Uttama Adhikari Vaishnava, is already considered a Brahmin, regardless of his birth or past deeds. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted this principle and recognized Srila Haridas Thakur as the Acharya of the Holy Name, although Thakur Haridas appeared in a Mohammedan family. In conclusion, Srila Shukadeva Goswami was born a Vaishnava, and therefore Brahmanism was included in him. He did not have to undergo any ceremonies. Any low-born person, be he a Kirata, Puna, Andhra, Pulinda, Pulkasha, Abhira, Shumba, Yavana, Kasa, or even lower, can be delivered to the highest transcendental position by the mercy of Vaishnavas. Srila Sukadeva Goswami was the spiritual master of Sri Sutta Goswami, who therefore offers his respectful obeisances unto Srila Shukadeva Goswami before he begins his answers to the questions of the sages of Namasharanya. Om Adinati Nirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksuru Nidhikam Jena Dasmai Shubhara Vahasi Chaitanya Manavisam Stapitab Jena Bhutala Svayam Uthapita Mayam Dhrati Svapranti Kham.
When I was reading this verse, which starts out, Srila Sutta Goswami said, it reminded me of another verse in the fourth chapter of the same canto. And Prabhupada's explanation of realization is so brilliant that I thought I should read it before speaking. So I'm going to just, if you'll indulge me, read this other verse, which is a particularly beautiful and brilliant explanation. The verse says, on hearing Sutta Goswami speak thus, Shonaka Muni, who was the elderly learned leader of all the rishis, engaged in that prolonged sacrificial ceremony, congratulated Sutta Goswami by addressing him as follows. And this is what Prabhupada writes in his purport. In a meeting of learned men, when there are congratulations or addresses for the speaker, the qualifications of the congratulator should be as follows. He must be the leader of the house and an elderly man. He must be vastly learned also. Sri Shonaka Rishi had all these qualifications, and thus he stood up to congratulate Sri Sutta Goswami when he expressed his desire to present Srimad Bhagavatam exactly as he heard it from Shukadeva Goswami and also realized it personally. Personal realization does not mean that one should, out of vanity, attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya, and at the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. That sentence is in italics, which means that Prabhupada wanted to emphasize that sentence. The original purpose of the text must be maintained. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. This is called realization. The leader of the assembly, Shonaka, could estimate the value of the speaker, Sri Sutta Goswami, simply by uttering yathaditam and yathamati, and therefore he was very glad to congratulate him in ecstasy. No learned man should be willing to hear a person who does not represent the original acharya. So the speaker and the audience were bona fide in this meeting, where Bhagavatam was being recited for the second time. That should be the standard of recitation of Bhagavatam, so that the real purpose can be served without difficulty. Unless this situation is created, Bhagavatam recitation for extraneous purposes is useless labor, both for the speaker and for the audience. This is a particularly brilliant explanation of the meaning of realization. An explanation by Srila Prabhupada. And we understand many things from this. First of all, we understand that Shukadeva Goswami spoke the Bhagavatam, but his words weren't repeated verbatim. They were repeated by Sutta Goswami, but he spoke according to his own realization. Not that he was like a just trying to repeat everything word for word, syllable by syllable, letter for letter, but he was speaking from his own realization. And Prabhupada explains what realization means. He says that the original purpose of the text must be maintained. So in Sanskrit we call this siddhanta. We have to try to understand what the acharyas meant. Not simply, we don't simply try to repeat what they said, but we try to understand what they meant. And this is called realization. This is the reason why personalities like Srila Prabhupada are so glorified in society. This is the reason why great personalities are remembered in society. This is the reason why persons like Srila Prabhupada have a great influence on society. This is the reason why great personalities change millions of lives. This is the reason why great personalities establish a philosophy, even if such a philosophy is not popular, even if such a philosophy is not likable by what Prabhupada calls crude people, crude men. One of the marks of a truly great person is that they can create a taste, they can create a thirst and a hunger for something which is ordinarily not sought after. People generally want to feel that their senses are gratified in some way or other. And marketeers pride themselves in being able to tailor their product or their service to the tastes of whatever public they're trying to reach. But a truly great, maybe we could say revolutionary, person like Srila Prabhupada didn't pander to the tastes of anyone, any public, but he succeeded in creating a taste where there was no taste. Even among crude people who had no taste for anything transcendental, the mark of greatness is that even among such persons, even in the midst of such an atmosphere that is so against anything spiritual, somehow a taste is created. And as Prabhupada has written, if the original meaning of the text is maintained, then that taste can be manifest within the heart of anyone. And that is how, according to what we read, how hearts are changed. Hard hearts become soft hearts. And crude people become sensitive people. And atheistic people can become theistic people. This is a radical transformation, to go from atheist to theist. This is realization. Sometimes we've heard Prabhupada say that, why am I being glorified? I have done nothing unusual. All I've done is try to preserve what I've learned, what I've heard, what I've read. All I have tried to do is pass on what has been taught to me without any change, without any adulteration, without any personal motive. And if there's anything that can be said for my having done anything, and he was very reluctant to even say my, he would usually say we, it's because I haven't changed anything. It's because this is the genuine article. It's not diluted, it's not watered down, it's not changed. So realization, from what we understand from Prabhupada's words here, is somehow to preserve the original meaning, and yet, within preserving that original meaning, as he says, you must have full confidence in the previous acharya, just like we. It's very similar, isn't it, to the way we have great confidence in Srila Prabhupada. Some of us have never physically met him or laid eyes on him in person. And we're so convinced. We have such, we can call it blind faith almost, that he's a perfect person, that he hasn't changed anything. Of course, we've read his books, we've read his tapes, we've watched his videos. And we've heard it said so many times that he didn't change anything. No obscure meaning should be screwed out of it, yet, Prabhupada writes, it should be presented in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience. So every audience is different. Every part of the world has its own traditions, its own religions, its own standards of behavior. Traditions. And it's different everywhere. The way people act in Thailand and Australia and South Africa and Iceland and India and America, they're all different. So Prabhupada, who was a world preacher and preached in all these parts of the world, was able to somehow preserve all of the great things, all of the great original teachings, without changing the meaning of them, preserving the Siddhanta, and yet he created a taste where there was no taste. He created a market where there was no market. He created an interest where there was no interest. He created devotees where there were no devotees. He changed atheists to theists. And there's an incident that probably many of you have heard before, where Prabhupada was in a train compartment and one of his compatriots asked him to perform a miracle. Someone wanted him to show a universal form, or to levitate, or to become invisible, or to make something else disappear. And there were devotees in the same compartment. Some of them were shaved, wearing tilaks. And Prabhupada thought for a few seconds, and then he gestured to his devotees and he said, "This is my miracle. This is my miracle." White people with shaved heads and tilaks and devotees and ladies and saris. So there is no greater miracle, because we can understand, and I think we all know, that these people were, at least many of them, atheists, or agnostics at least, and yet somehow this miracle occurred. They transformed. They became what Prabhupada called mad after God, or someone said that to him, that these people, they're mad after God. And Prabhupada quoted something once from, I think it was from a Shakespeare play. It said something like, and this is also a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the idea is that the lover, the poet, and the madman are all compact in mind. And it's also stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam that the people who are truly content are either completely self-realized, like Das and Sri Goswami and Sri Deva Goswami, completely detached, or they're completely mad. They don't care about anything. Those are the people who are really content with the world. So in a sense, to be on the transcendental path, to be a serious aspirant to spiritual life, means to be a little mad. We're all a little bit mad, maybe. We're sitting here doing about a little blue boy playing the flute, has lots of girlfriends, loved butter, used to steal butter, had lots of girlfriends, made sure a lot of people died in the Kurukshetra war, who is a thief, a philanderer, and a killer, and yet we think he's God. This murderer, this philanderer, this thief, who is running after people to get the dust from their feet, to liberate the whole world, that's God. You have to be a little bit mad
little bit crazy. Prabhupada told a story about a person who was accused of murder in a court case, and the civil servant was called in. The physician, psychiatrist, to determine whether he could be freed on insanity plea. And he said, "Your worship," they used to call him "Your worship" in those days. As far as I'm concerned, they're all crazy. Anyone who commits murder, he's crazy. So if you can let this guy go, you can have let them all go. So we've heard Prabhupada even say this from time to time, that to be a devotee means to be a little crazy, because when we look around us, everyone is after happiness from the senses, happiness from thrones and boats and cars and planes and material progress, education, beauty, wealth, material progress, aristocracy. Everyone thinks these things are just wonderful. And someone who doesn't think such things are wonderful, or that they're worth sacrificing their lives for, are a little bit crazy. But that's all right. Actually, people like Hare Krishnas partly because they are a little crazy. They don't sit in front of the TV with a beer in one hand, petting the dog in the other hand all day long. There's something else. Something else that they get pleasure from. Something they don't understand, something invisible, something within. And the Bhagavad Gita tells us that one's happiness is within, who is active and rejoices within him, whose aim is inward. That person is the perfect mystic and is liberated and supreme, ultimately attains the supreme. So what is this inner joy? Why are we being entertained so much? What is it? The thing that we can't see that's making us so happy, so content. Isn't it more of a contentedness than a happiness? It's not passionate, it's not frivolous, but we just feel satisfied. Lord Chaitanya gave his disciples a very big project. He wanted that everybody in the whole, not just people in little rooms or in temples, listen to philosophy or lectures about Krishna consciousness, that they should be happy. But he wanted the whole world, not just human beings, but everybody. So he talked about the flood of love of God that Lord Chaitanya began. And when there's a flood, as everyone knows, even the snakes are buoyed up to the top of the water. So the metaphor of a flood is very appropriate. Lord Chaitanya started something. He started this great flood. And Prabhupada didn't see himself as somebody great who started something called his time. But he saw that this was something that Krishna himself started 5,000 years ago. So Lord Chaitanya promoted and made even more widespread 500 years ago. Sometimes it's thought, sometimes people criticize Hare Krishna. Oh, you watch TV, you have all these cell phones, and you're driving cars. Once I was getting into a car in San Diego, and some girls were walking by, riding by on their bicycles. I didn't think you people drove cars. So in one way, the great thing, the gift that Prabhupada gave us, was to show us that there's nothing wrong with driving cars, or fixing cars, or using cell phones, or cameras. Once Sandeep was with me and a few other people, we walked up to the top of Mount Warning. Mount Warning is the place in Eastern Australia where the sun first hits that continent, that big island. And we got to the top at about 11 o'clock. It's a pretty rigorous climb. We had to go through a rainforest and then climb over some rocks. And we got to the top, and there was a fellow who had been staying all night to watch the sunrise, and he was still in his, I guess he'd gone back to sleep in his sleeping bag. they saw my video camera. They just stared at that video camera. The first thing he said,
first words out of his mouth was, "What were? Where's your cell phone, Baba?"
Once I was passing through the customs in New Zealand, and I had my stroller thing full of suitcases, my baggage rack, and somehow he just looked at me. It was in kind of the last phase. That's an awful lot of stuff for a month. Go over to the Red Shell, and then they opened everything and examined all of my bags. And it was a very long, tedious process. So sometimes my point is that people look at us sideways because we use all this technology. How can we do it? I'm talking on the phone, someone's recording this. But this is what Prabhupada gave us, wasn't it? And really, it's not just Prabhupada's gift. It's Rupa Goswami's gift. It's Yukta Vairagya. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. And sometimes we think that, oh, we see all these tapes of Prabhupada. We hear all these Kaliyuga sets of Prabhupada. We have so many books, thousands and thousands and maybe millions of books and pamphlets. And we hear this great music. Devotees singing such beautiful songs in Vrindavan. We can hear them on tapes and on CDs. And Prabhupada made all this possible. In the wake of Lord Chaitanya, it was spread all over the world. Previous to Prabhupada and maybe to Bhaktisiddhanta, not too far back, maybe 100 years ago, people, they might have a guru somewhere in some remote part of India. The guru might have one or two disciples. But now Prabhupada has created, he is the prime guru, and he's created this wonderful ability to see him on tape, to hear him, to see him, to read his books, to go to his temples in every part of the world, to go into his restaurants, to be with the devotees everywhere, to hear the holy name chanted on the street corners and the streets and byways of every major city of the world. And that's truly amazing. How has this happened in just 10 years, 15, 20, maybe 30 years? But it was even happening in the first 10 years because Prabhupada was relentlessly traveling. And what was he teaching? What was he saying? What was different about him? He possessed realization. He wasn't changing anything. He was giving us the Siddhanta. He was presenting what had been presented thousands of years ago by Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. He wasn't doing anything different. I heard one tape. Prabhupada was speaking in Durban. And one of the audience, a man who sounded like he had an Indian accent, said, "Now, please show us your universal form." And there was a long silence, and then Prabhupada said, "What? You're asking me?" Like he was just incredulous. And he said, "Yes, show us your universal form." I said, "I can show you a universal form." He said, "I don't have this kind of power. What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you must have some kind of power. You have so many students, so many disciples, so many temples all over the world. Certainly, and so many books. You must have power." And Prabhupada stopped a minute and he said, "My only power is to tell the fools and rascals of the world that Krishna is God. That's all." So he very nicely put this person in his place without offending him. Without directly calling him a fool or a rascal, but that's the miracle of passing on truth, real truth, not relative truth, but absolute truth. And that's real gift, isn't it? Isn't that the gift that Prabhupada gives? Because everything in this world that we see, everything that we enjoy, everyone that we meet, everything is surrounded by relativity, even morality. If someone thinks I'm obedient, I'm good, I'm faithful and honest, whatever honesty may be in anyone's mind, that's it. That's morality. Whatever anyone believes is moral and good and loyal and honest and faithful and obedient, that's morality. The Prophet said something very different, something very unusual, and he called it absolute. That's a way that people shrink from, they revolt from
the idea that
something can be absolute, or that a person can be perfect. How can a person be perfect? Everything and everyone is just full of flaws. There's no such thing as perfect. But we're sitting in this room because we think that there is such a thing as perfection in a person. We think that there's such a thing as absolute. We think that a philosophy can be perfect. And that may be a bit mad, but if that is what truth is, then better to be a little mad than to be completely engulfed in sense gratification and thinking that everything is relative and not having any fixed purpose in life. This fixed purpose is very important. It's mentioned. Vyavasaya nikabuddhi
ekeha kuru nandana, that we should be very focused.
In our mind. We may be doing many different things. We may have many responsibilities to carry out. And we do. And we have to carry them out. Because everything we do belongs to Krishna. Our own possessions, our own family, our own appearance, our own clothes, our own body. Everything belongs to Krishna. So we have to take care of it. We have these responsibilities. The transcendentalist who is fixed, the other side, aka Hakuru Nandana, the one who is fixed and one-minded, is never deviated, even in the midst of so many responsibilities. Because we have so many things we have to do just to pay the rent, just to earn a living. So many forms to fill out, so many numbers to crunch. But the transcendentalist is aka Hakuru Nandana. The other side, aka Hakuru Nandana. Not diverted, not dissuaded from original purpose. It's kind of like sometimes they say that spiritual life is off the razor's edge. It's kind of like walking a tightrope, isn't it? Without getting distracted. And the tightrope walkers, they have to concentrate. It's very dangerous. You ever seen them in the circus? I've seen them without any nets underneath. They look so easy. But they have to concentrate very, very hard to make sure that they don't lose their balance. And it's very easy, in spiritual life to lose balance. Very, very easy, because temptations are on every side, from above, from below, and from every side. So when we have been told that spiritual life is like declaring war on Maya, the soldier is very one-pointed in the mind. You have to do so many things. Put on the boots, to pack the guns, to make sure the pins and the hand grenades are all right. But the whole point is to win a war. That's the focus. That's the mission. So, I remember reading one of Ravindra Sarupa Prabhu's offerings on Vyasa Puja, and he very beautifully compared Prabhupada to the general. He said that he saw, I'm sure some of you have read this often a few years back, a file that was Prabhupada's incoming letters. And in that file were letters from people who were Prabhupada's leaders. They were having all kinds of problems, serious spiritual difficulties, not just little problems, but big problems. And they were the leaders. And in his offering, he said, well, maybe I shouldn't have seen this file, but I did see it. And by seeing it, he marveled all the more that Prabhupada knew about all these things that were going on, all these very difficult situations that were arising. And yet, he didn't appear ever to flag, even slightly. He never appeared to get deviated from his purpose. And in this way, Ravindra Sarupa compared him to the general. Because in the army, the generals, the lieutenants, the captains, they see their men die and they see them mutilated. And they see horror happen right before their eyes, time after time. But they don't flag. They know they've got to win. They know they've got to carry out their mission, their duty. So this was how this great devotee thought of Srila Prabhupada as a great general who, in the midst of so many difficulties, so many temptations to have to placate people, to have to counsel them, to explain things. Somehow he, and he did all that. It's not that he didn't do it. He wrote letters every day, sometimes 15, 20 letters a day. When we would see him in his room, say in London, and he's holding darshan, he would be thinking about what was going on in Hawaii, in Buenos Aires, in Melbourne, in Moscow. He would be meditating on very complex, difficult, legal, social, personal problems that would take judges years to solve. He was solving them one after the other after just by writing letters. So he was never deviated, even though he had every reason to be deviated, but he never deviated. He was very fixed, very, very singular in his purpose. He told some of his disciples who were promoting his understanding of science, he told them that if I say these things, people say, oh, he's an old man, what does he know? But if you say these things, you're a scientist, you're a PhD, you got lots of experience, you're an author, you've written papers, you've been published, you're a teacher, you've worked with people, and then they're going to believe you. But why should they? I mean, why should they even stick their necks out and say something that's so revolutionary, so against the grain? The prophet was so convinced, that, for example, that the moon is farther away than the sun, that we never went to the moon. He was so convinced, so absolutely certain, so sure, that even the scientists said, yes, this is the truth. And even if we have to defy everything that our teachers have told us, everything that's written in the textbooks, everything that we have to nod our heads to and say yes to the instructors in our classrooms, if we have to write books that counter everything that's in all the other books, history books, science books, whatever they may be, we're going to do it. Why? Because Prabhupada is convinced. And not only was he convinced, but he had, this was knowledge that he didn't invent. This is knowledge. It's eternal. This is not just 1,500 years old. It's not just 5,000 years old from the time it was written, but it goes back and back and back to time immemorial. These truths, one of our presidents wrote, are self-evident. But the real self-evident truths are the truths of the Vedas. The truth of Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. And it's these Siddhantas that make us feel very, very satisfied. When we heard that Prabhupada wanted Varnashram Dharma to be widespread, sometimes we misunderstand, we expect that everyone has to immediately stand up and identify themselves. I'm a Kshatriya, I'm a Brahmin, I'm a Shudra. But actually he wanted everyone in the world to be involved, to be acting in some way that was Haritoshana, that was satisfying the Lord Hari. So Prabhupada, he actually took on the whole world. When he wanted something like Varnashram, we're talking here about major social agenda, social change. And this doesn't happen overnight. This doesn't happen in 1 week or 1 year or 10 or 20 years. This may take centuries. Prabhupada sometimes referred to Marxist philosophy. Karl Marx in his lifetime was thought to be kind of a crazy, bearded, grizzled, poor, hopeless philosopher. But in time, he wrote a lot of books, his philosophy came to rule for about 70, 80 years, a very large number of people, 400 million or so. So it was Prabhupada's conviction that his books might take a long time for people to understand and to act on, but that they would affect major change, not just in four. This was Prabhupada's conviction. He wanted the whole world, not just 400 million, but with talking in terms of billions of people to be affected. And he's written like this. So it's a big assignment. It's a big mission that he's laid out before us to do our best. And even if we don't get all 6 billion people, if we just get even one person to really understand, then Prabhupada quoted that famous saying that one moon is better than millions of stars. So, in the wake of a great person, one can feel content even if someone gets a little prasad in life. Even if someone likes the hospitality of the devotional service and the devotee, even if someone likes the devotee, that's a step in the right direction. That's a step towards satisfying the whole world. At least in Prabhupada's eyes, that was a significant step. And according to what he said about realization, we should act in such a way that everyone is pleased. He says, personal realization does not mean that one should out of vanity attempt to show one's own learning by trying to surpass the previous acharya. He must have full confidence in the previous acharya. At the same time, he must realize the subject matter so nicely that he can present the matter for the particular circumstances in a suitable manner. Now, are we doing that? Are we presenting the subject matter in a suitable manner? Are we realized? So realization is not such a small, insignificant thing. It's the essence of being Krishna conscious, is to realize. It's not just to understand. We can understand so many things, I'm not this body, intellectually. But how many of us actually realize that? And how many of us act in a realized way? How many of us are actually not changing the original purpose of the text, not screwing out any obscure meaning, and yet presenting the philosophy somehow in an interesting manner for the understanding of the audience? This is called realization. So it's a big task, not an easy task that he has laid before us. And there are many, many ways that we're all engaged in. And I don't mean to be critical, because I'm probably the worst offender at not being able to say things in a suitable way to please. But there are so many ways Prabhupada has given us. He talked about culture and cultural conquest. He produced beautiful paintings in his books. He loved beautiful architecture. He loved beautiful music when it was applied to Krishna consciousness. So he understood how people, especially in the West, because in India, if your clothes are a little bit wrinkled, or if your beard's growing out a little bit, you're not so offensive. You know, you're a sadhu. But Prabhupada came to the most materialistic part of the world, came to New York City, came to the concrete jungle, where people really do look you up and down. When we were in London, he looked at me once and he said, "Your coat is a little soiled." Yeah. And then he said, "In London you dress, then address." You understand? Dress, then address. Oh, yes, Prabhupada. I understand. But the little things like that, I mean, it means so much. Because they did. People in London, they used to look us up and down. What kind of shoes are you wearing? Well, you know, if there's a little mark on your coat, it doesn't go unnoticed. You're out. You don't count. So just things like that. Prabhupada, he noticed everything. And I think you know this. Some of you have read Dhanavir's, Prabhu's Maharaj's book. Some of us were criticized because a woman was singing Govinda Mari Purusham Samandagam in the early days. And we were all devastated. We heard, "Oh, Prabhupada doesn't like this. That a woman singing Govinda." And we had worked so hard to make this a reality. We'd gone into the recording studio. We you know, really thought that this was going to change, you know, in those days. We were change the world. But then when we heard Prabhupada doesn't like it, it's no good, all out the window. So then Prabhupada actually hadn't heard it, but someone started this rumor that Prabhupada didn't like it. So in the temple room, Prabhupada was in his Vyasa Sun, and the the doors in the Los Angeles temple were open and the deities were exposed. And then Prabhupada took one of those and said, "What is that record from London?" And they said, "Oh, yes." And Prabhupada said, "Well, I haven't heard it. And could you play it?" And they said, "Oh, yes, we'll play it." So then some time went by. And Prabhupada said, "Why are you hesitating? Play it." And the devotee said, "You mean play it here on the speaker system in front of everybody in the deities and the big loudspeakers?" Still, and people noticed that tears started streaming down his cheeks. And at the end of the song, he said that this should be played in every temple all over the world. Whenever you open the deity doors, everywhere, at 7 o'clock, whatever time the deities were open. And not long after that, some months, he got a letter from one of his disciples, a man, saying that actually Prabhupada, in the letter he said, "I don't think this is proper. I think you should use my version of Govindamadi Purusham." Because he had done something musical. And Prabhupada wrote him back a letter, and he said, "No, we'll just leave things as they are, because actually this is symphony." Use the word symphony. I have that letter. So I'm just mentioning this, not because I was involved in this record, but because Prabhupada had such a deep appreciation for culture, whether it was music or architecture or art or dress, whatever it was. When he saw that his books were being produced on a computer, he was overjoyed. He didn't say, "Oh, these machines are all Maya." He went through the BBT and he was so enlightened to see all these machines being used in the service of the Lord and being able to produce books so fast and so perfectly. He was very, very happy. So this is one of the great gifts that Prabhupada has given us. And it's hard for many people to understand what he did. In addition to being a great unswerving, unflagging guru, keeping all of the Siddhanta in line and in order, he was kind of like a CEO, we might say, of his organization. He was thinking, when he was in London, of faraway places, and he was making decisions every day in his letters. And he grew his organization in that first 10 years of his traveling in this country to something very big, something worldwide. I took a man to meet Prabhupada once. This man was about 28 years old. He was going to retire at 30. He was an advisor to the Rothschild family. Cecil and Rothschild was one of his bosses. He was a financial expert and a legal and a lawyer. And at 28, he decided he would make enough money to retire at 30. And so he went, and he was very kind of a brilliant person. I mean, maybe he was a little bit boastful, but at any rate, he went to meet Prabhupada. I took him to meet Prabhupada, and that was in about 1971. And he met, I'm sorry, 1973 it was. He met devotees, and he went to the temple. He talked with Prabhupada for some time, and then after his meeting with Prabhupada, he was walking outside, and he said, "You know, this defies all the rules of finance and jurisprudence and legalities. I don't understand. I've talked to these people. I've met your master. It doesn't make sense how it could be all over the world in such a short time, so well organized." He actually could not believe. He couldn't figure it out. It didn't add up financially. The numbers didn't work. It just completely blew his mind that so much had been done in just a few years. In that time, it was like 6 or 7 years that Prabhupada's, maybe not even that long, 4 or 5 years that Prabhupada really had done anything with ISKCON, 5 years, 6 years. So this is his realization. He didn't change anything. He wasn't crunching numbers, but he appreciated everything that could be used in the service of Krishna, and he appreciated that everything could be used in the service of Krishna if it wasn't polluted, if people knew how to do it. He had great appreciation, and it was for that reason that his stature has become what it is. He didn't change anything. He was a realized person, truly realized person. So I suppose I could talk for a few more hours about Prabhupada, but I'd like to hear from you. Gaur, please.
Question, Mark?
Yeah.
My question is, how can we understand that Prabhupada gave suggestions of rules and regulations that seem, maybe from for example, different devotees, aspiring devotees may have difficulty with some of the regulative principles in their most orthodox interpretation. How is it that we can understand that Prabhupada wanted to encourage devotees to take initiation, but at the same time, some of the standards may seem that they may not be reachable for many, many years, even after initiation, devotees may struggle so much with regular principles. How do we understand that we can have faith in Srila Prabhupada and understand that why he did that, or why it is that? Do you understand that question?
Yeah. Did everyone hear his question? I'll repeat it. He asked, why was it that when Prabhupada wrote and spoke, sometimes he seemed very strict, and he did implement a system of regulated principles as requirements for initiation. No gambling. No eating, no illicit sex, no gambling. What else?
Intoxication.
No intoxication and chant 16 rounds. So the question is, isn't that kind of, you know, making it impossible for someone to, you know, aspire for, because it's so strict? And how can Prabhupada achieve this kind of universal status as a great person when he insisted on his strictness?
And also that even after initiation, many devotees still struggle with those vows.
Okay, and also that even after initiation, people still struggle with those vows. And how is it that Prabhupada, how do we think of Prabhupada? So this is a very important question. And it can be answered in different ways. One of the ways that it can be answered is to say that Prabhupada set a standard that was so lofty and so unbelievably high that nobody could follow it. I mean, that's one way to understand it. And that people appreciate that loftiness, because he himself, first of all, when he said, I am not this body, I mean, as far as I was concerned, that was it for me. I thought, well, this guy really, he's not his body. That's pretty far out. And then I started thinking, well, if he thinks that way, maybe there's some truth in it. And gradually, I began to think that way. So that was a very primitive form of realization. And when I was initiated in very early days, I had no idea about regulated principles. It's just, you know, I didn't hear about it until I was about initiated. And I thought, well, okay, be strict, and, you know, we're supposed to follow this, but I mean, hey, who can do it? He said different things. I mean, he, at one point, when after some time had gone by, had elapsed, and he had a few disciples, he would talk about something like celibacy, for example, and he said that it's a very powerful thing, and that we're doing it, and I think the Brahma Kumaris, and the Swami Narayans, and Mahatma Gandhi, or Mohandas Gandhi, whatever his name is, they practiced it, and this made it very powerful. There's something very, very empowering about it, the idea of a man not passing semen, getting the energy back to his brain. It takes so many pounds of blood to get one drop of semen, and so on. And so that just even on an intellectual basis, it became very important for us to realize, well, here, this is very very powerful thing. And here's a person, he's celibate, he's realized, he hasn't lost anything, he's creating a big movement. So even though it's in many cases an impossible thing to do, people were taking vows in front of the fire, in front of the guru, in front of the deities, in front of the Vaishnavas. They're going to be celibate for the rest of their lives. You know, and it's a very strict vow. And yet, people came to those initiations they watched and they thought, wow, this is really something. And it's not that nobody follows it. Many do. Many are able to follow these very rigorous vows. And it's one of the things that has given Krishna consciousness so much power. So much power. People say, didn't I see you in Honolulu? Didn't I see you in Calcutta? Didn't I see you in Melbourne? But Prabhupada has done this thing. No intoxication. No gambling. No meat eating. And people think these are great things. I mean, I was amazed in San Diego once a couple came to the temple. They were dressed in black, young couple, and they're 19, 20 years old. The men's pants were torn out at the knee. They had things dangling from their ears. They had different kinds of body piercing. And they wandered into the temple, and they started to talk to me. What's all this about? So I immediately turned them on to someone their age, because I thought, I don't want to have anything to do with these people. I can't even talk to them anyway. So they talked with one of the devotees in the temple, and then I asked the devotee who talked to me, I said, well, what do they want? He said, wow, they were just in bliss. When I told them that we don't take any intoxication, they said, man, that is great. That's fantastic. That's one of the greatest things I've ever heard. Because, you know, in their way of seeing things, this is actually a great thing. Maybe their parents were drunk. Who knows? But they thought all of these principles were great. Celibacy, no intoxication, no eating, no gambling. They thought this was great. And I was amazed that here they were, the rebels, thinking that this movement had something very, very special to offer. So these things that... And Allen Ginsberg was a famous person in the 60s. And he used to tell Prabhupada, you're too strict, Swami. People will never follow you. And then there was a whole issue of whether it's going to be called International Society for God Consciousness or International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And I was the one who opted for God Consciousness. And Kirtananda was there and he said, no, I think Krishna Consciousness is better. Prabhupada said, yeah, I think Krishna Consciousness. And in a lecture he said that it has to be Krishna. It can't be anything else. And on Janmashtami, when he was asked by reporters once, what is this? What's this all about? And he said, this is an honor of our dear Lord Krishna. So, I mean, you know, Prabhupada wasn't pandering to any whims or anything. He was strict. He was strict. And he said, these are the rules. And you've got to chant 16 rounds. You've got to follow these four regulated principles. And even though it's so against the grain today to not to take intoxication or have illicit sex or to not eat meat or to gamble or play the stock market or whatever, in fact, it's almost impossible. The tires in the car you're driving have some kind of animal products in them. The stocks you invest in, what if they change their portfolio and they start investing in pork bellies? And what do you do? I mean, everything, we're living in a contaminated world. It's almost impossible. And yet, Prabhupada followed all these things himself, and many of his followers. And we think that this, and people think that this is unique, this is wonderful. Whether they're rebels, whether they're the people that write who's who in religion. But Prabhupada made that mark, he created that taste. And part of it was restriction. Okay, you get this higher taste, but you've got to give up this lower taste in order to get it. And somehow it rang true. People were able to do it. So, I mean, it's a very good question and a very broad topic, and we could probably discuss it all night, but these are just some reflections. I hope it's a little helpful. Yes? Yeah?
Maharaj, I know we can't imitate Prabhupada, obviously. Prabhupada is such a scholar and poet, and you just knew how to speak with people about Krishna consciousness so eloquently. So as we go about our daily lives, in our suits, in our professional appearance, sometimes not looking so Krishna conscious in our style, and we come across people on the phone talking about Christ and Christianity and 9/11, how confident as devotees outside of the temple that particular day should they be in using Krishna's name as opposed to concealing it and under the guise of God just because of our comfort level? Should we actually become more courageous as well as gentle and discriminating, but be more courageous in using his name when we respond and speak to people speaking about God?
Everybody hear her question?
Yeah,
basically, I think if I understood you right, you were asking about whether or not we should be willing to imitate Prabhupada to the point of talking about Krishna or God directly instead of indirectly to convince people that Krishna consciousness is a valid philosophy and way of life? Is that accurate? There's a fine line between imitation and following. Very fine line. Prabhupada often said, follow in the footsteps or follow in the footprints, but don't imitate. And he would tell us that. And I've seen, and we've probably all seen, people who try to imitate. They just say, well, Krishna is God, and if you don't believe that, you're not a vegetarian, just get out of my sight, because you don't count, you're not a human being. I mean, that's a sort of attempt at imitation, and it is a kind of cheap imitation of Prabhupada. I was in the temple once when someone came in London, and I don't know what started the conversation, but basically it was, if you eat meat, you don't belong here. You know, that kind of so-called preaching. So there, as I was saying, there's a fine line between imitation and following in the footsteps. And Prabhupada, because of his age and because of his nationality and because of his stature and his realization, he could say things in a way that we can't say them, because we are cheaply imitating him. We try to say things the way he said them. I mean, he would call people demons sometimes, scholars, and they liked it. I mean, can you call someone a demon and have them like it? Is that possible? It's not possible. I mean, at least I can't. And I wouldn't even want to try it. I mean, I'm even kind of reluctant to use the word because it's kind of got some strange connotations. Not that it can't be used. So when Prabhupada left us a mission to follow in the footsteps, he did. He created restaurants. In fact, in one letter, or it wasn't a letter, actually, it was an instruction that was printed in the form of a letter by his secretary at the time, 1974, I believe is the year. I've got this on my computer, so I know it's true. And he said, in America, we shouldn't open any more temples, just have restaurants with reading rooms. That's a famous instruction that Prabhupada gave. And Srila Krishnamurti will verify this, because he was the secretary who wrote the letter, and I've spoken with him about it. Prabhupada actually wanted that to happen. That was 1974. So my point is that he left us so many ways to convince people about Krishna consciousness, so much culture. And sometimes we won't even say God. What to speak of Krishna? We won't even say the G word. Sometimes when I was lecturing in a temple in Boston, I was talking about the G word, and people were kind of snickering. But they were also snickering with the kind of understanding that, well, yeah, it's like a swear word. We can't even say God because people hate it. They don't like to hear it. I mean, there, people who were thoughtful realized that the Crusades, the troubles in Northern Ireland and Palestine and Rwanda and so many other places were so supposedly religious squabbles. So they don't like to hear about God, but they like prasadam, they like hospitality, they like devotees, they like to hear people singing and dancing on the street, they like to read philosophy. So probably they like to see videos, they like to hear the beautiful music. There's just so many things. They like their intellects to be stimulated by Sarabhuda's books or Vidakarma's presentations. They need that. And everybody needs stimulation mentally, physically, emotionally, intellectually. And without that, you know, it's very hard for a person to just to get what we call sometimes a straight sauce. That's like cheap imitation. Prabhupada said it, so I'm going to say it. I feel this way, so I'm going to find a quote in the folio that Prabhupada said, whatever backs up, support, writes it, so that's the law, and that's it. But really, if we really research what Prabhupada said and thought about things carefully, there's a phenomenon known as Shishtachar. I don't know if you know this word, but Prajuna wrote about it. And he talked about how when there are, it's actually difficult to decipher what the Shastras say about a certain topic. Like there was the instance of Aswatthama, for example, in the Bhagavatam, whether he should have been killed or not, because he slaughtered some young boys who were unarmed in their sleep. That's against Vedic tradition. Therefore, one has a right to kill such a person and to alleviate their karma. So there was a big dispute about this in the Bhagavatam, and Bhima wanted to kill him, and Lord Krishna said, okay, that's all right. But then Draupadi said, well, wait a minute, he's the son of a Brahmin. Can't kill the son of a Brahmin. And his wife will be bereft of sons. And I don't want her to feel like I do, bereft of sin, so this is not right either, that he should be killed. So then Krishna reversed his position, and he said to Arjuna, he said, well, you've got to kill him and not kill him at the same time. It's in the Bhagavatam. You've got to kill him and not kill him. So how are you going to do it? And you have to use your intelligence. And Arjuna figured out how to do it, because what is worse than death?
Dishonor.
Yeah, humiliation, dishonor. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. So he figured out a way to dishonor him. He removed his kshatriya jewel and he sent him on his way. And it's still said that he's wandering around looking for a place to reside. He made him bereft of any home and being a kshatriya. He took his status away from him. And that humiliation was worse than dying. So these are the kinds of things that are charged. Use your intelligence, your sharp intelligence, not to imitate, but to follow in the footsteps, to figure out somehow or other to tax the brain. Prabhupada was talking about the end of the sixth chapter, Yogi Nam, Visarvishan, Makite Nantaratmam, and he said, what is the perfect yogi? It's brain taxation, Prabhupada was saying in a lecture. And if you tax your brain to figure out how to spread Krishna consciousness, then you are Yogi Nam, Visarvishan, then you're the perfect yogi. If you this brain taxation, he said, is the secret to controlling the mind. That's real dhyana yoga. Tax the brain how to spread Krishna consciousness. So that's following in the footsteps, but not imitating. That realization, in other words. Other comments or questions? Yeah, interactive. We're trying to create a more interactive dialogue. Ms. Rina.
Why is Prabhupada mentioned here in the Prabhupada? Sukadeva Goswami is a Vaishnava by his Bhagavad Gita. Here we understand the meaning of Vaishnava means Vishnu Aradhayate Iti Vaishnava, who is worship Vishnu. So now Sukadeva Goswami in the meditation, actually which form he worshiping or meditating?
Which form?
Yeah. In the jungle, when he went from Vyasadeva, in the home, then he went from meditation.
Yeah. So, let me just see if I understand your question right. It was about Shukadeva Goswami, and the question was, he was understood as a great Vaishnava, and a great Vaishnava worships without any aparas. Who was he worshipping? What was he meditating on? So, one of the ways we can understand Shukadeva Goswami is to understand that he is Nitya Siddha. Prabhupada said there are different kinds of Siddha. Siddha means perfect or perfect person. So there's Nitya Siddhas, there's Sadhana Siddhas, and there's Kripa Siddhas. And Nitya Siddha is said to be one who is perfect from birth, maybe from past lives, from past lives. A Sadhana Siddha is one who perfects the various rules and rituals and regulations of Krishna consciousness and is considered perfect at the end of life and has a samadhi. And the Kripa Siddha is one who gets the mercy. Kripa means mercy, the causeless mercy of the Lord. And from our point of view, for no apparent reason, is given either liberation or the highest perfection of life. That's Kripa Siddha. So, this was actually posed as a question to Prabhupada. Well, what are these different kinds of siddhas? And what are you? Are you a Nitya Siddha? Are you a Sadhana Siddha? Are you a Kripa Siddha? And Prabhupada answered by saying that if you're a siddha, whether you're a Kripa Siddha, a Sadhana Siddha, or a Nitya Siddha, it doesn't matter. And he used the metaphor of rivers running into the ocean. And he said that once the water has run into the ocean, we don't consider what river it came from. It's ocean water. So he said that when one is siddha, whether one is Nitya Siddha, Kripa Siddha, or Sadhana Siddha, it's the same thing. You're a perfect person. So Prahlad Maharaj, another example, Nitya Siddha, Prabhupada called him Nitya Siddha. Narada Muni, on the other hand, is considered to be a Sadhana Siddha, someone who served the Vaishnavas. He was like a maidservant, and then he became realized person. So this term Nitya, which also means eternal, and Prabhupada talked about the Nitya Siddhas and the Nitya Bhadas, eternally conditioned or eternally liberated. How can that be?
And he said, his answer was, well, nitya means it's so far back that you can't remember. That's the definition of a nitya siddha, that you've been perfect for so long. I remember when I was maybe 14, there was a book called 1-2-3 Infinity by a mathematician named George Gamow. And his thesis was that people whose brains aren't very developed can't think in numbers beyond 3. So any number beyond 3, to that person, is infinity. So that was kind of what that was about. So nitya means that we just can't remember that far back. So whether we're sadhana siddha, nitya siddha, or jiva siddha. So Shukadeva Goswami was obviously a nitya siddha Vaishnava, and his meditation was obviously on Krishna. He was always searching for Krishna, and he was always fixed in Krishna consciousness from his very birth. So for that reason, he was in the womb so long, so many years, and that was his meditation. That's my understanding. Yes. Priya.
I just wanted to make a comment on what you were saying. As far as presenting Krishna consciousness in a palatable and an understandable way to the other person, I think that probably you're the best in that work. And the real pioneer in terms of if you work with coming back, pretending you're happy, and the higher taste, and some of the other activities that you've been involved in, that they're just really helpful to spread Krishna consciousness. I just want to make that point that I think if anyone with this commentary of a problem, is anyone who has shortened
well, I have to respond to that. I have to respond to that because I'm just trying to think if there's anything worthwhile. I don't really think that I've done anything. I mean, I honestly think that I'm just a very average or below average person. I'm really convinced of that. And if there's any room for applause or anything, any kind of sort of affirmation of something extraordinary, I think there's a difference between going from sinner to saint and from shipwrecked to shipworthy. And I mean, I think I was shipwrecked and I become sort of seaworthy a little bit. But I don't think I don't think it's so radical that I could come in a category of saint. But Priya Bharata and I, we go back a long time and we have great respect for one another. And I would say the same thing about him, actually, because I really feel that way. I think the most wonderful thing really is that we're living in the wake of a truly great person, of Prabhupada. So he was really the master of all these things. I mean, okay, you know, so I edit some things and I try to speak in a certain way. But there are really many great persons in this Krishna consciousness movement who are applying their crafts, so to speak. Whatever they may be. It may be speaking, it may be video, it may be cooking, maybe architecture, art, or dance, or drama, so many things. But because those who are faithful to the Siddhanta and not changing anything, we're just following the wake of a great person. That's what it's all about, isn't it, really? So, I mean, I appreciate your sentiments, Priya. I want to say that's what I really think, though. Thanks anyway. So, yeah.
I was just going to make a comment about what Prabhu's question about whether to present Krishna consciousness directly or indirectly, and your elaboration about the meaning of imitation of realized souls. I had an embarrassing experience in 1972 trying to preach Krishna consciousness artificially in a very direct way by imitation. And at that time, I was going to high school, and I was wearing dhoti and tilak and shaved head and sikkim. And so I was thinking that everywhere I went in my classes, I had to inject Krishna consciousness. And I did.
How old were you?
I was 15 at the time.
These are the confessions of a 15-year-old Hare Krishna. Good.
So, it never occurred to me that it was enough to be in the classroom wearing a shaved head and sika and dhoti and all that. But I just remember one moment in the history class where the professor was discussing Alexander the Great and described his exploits and then asked for opinions. Everybody said something, then I raised my hand, she looked at me and I said, well, I think he should have chanted Hare Krishna. So a big collective groan went up from the classroom. So I learned that the direct way is not always the best way. But it can be sometimes. I think maybe the answer to one other answer to the question is just that as long as you use your power of discrimination and make an effort, that Srila Prabhupada will give you intelligence.
I think, Maharaj, the two words in Sanskrit called Anukaran and Anusharan.
Yeah.
So sometimes the preacher should remember time, place, and circumstances. And some circumstances, direct order also very, very valuable and effective. But not
effective. Yeah. Srimati is making the distinction between anusharan and anukaran. Following by remembering and following by acting. And that direct preaching, so to speak, has its place. And sometimes it's actually necessary. Just like I was trying to say, that Prabhupada didn't compromise. So there's times, and again, it's a very individual thing. Speaking to some person, and they want to hear about God, and they want to hear about Krishna, and someone else just doesn't want to hear about it, but they might like you, and they might like Prashara, and they might like what you're doing, and they might like the vibes. So, yeah. Go ahead, yeah. I think you have to maybe speak a little louder.
I was just thinking along that line of preaching and some of the opportunities that Krishna gives us to use our intelligence. I would like to share this because nowadays we're so much into the mental concept. People are accepting mental illness and people are... And when I left Potomac a few years ago, I had placed myself in one of the greatest and most famous mental illness hospitals in Philadelphia, Grand Hospital, as an outpatient, I should emphasize. I wasn't quite over the... But anyway, the first day of 10 consecutive days that I was going to meetings, wondering why I was feeling so insane, was an introduction. Every meeting, every morning, we had to go around in a circle and introduce ourselves. And there must have been about 25 men and women in this group. And each one of them, as they progressed towards me, towards my turn, they would say, I'm Mary Jones, I have bipolar depression, my doctor was taken away because my insurance wouldn't cover me any longer after such a relationship was developed, and I'm totally devastated. And the next one was Tom Jones, and my name is such and such, and I have deep, dark depressions, and I'm on medication for life. And this went on and on and on, and each one was so incredibly discouraged, and as they're doing this is my first day, everybody seems to know each other well from repeated visits, and I wasn't sure how to properly present myself being a devotee, etc., etc. So finally I just turned it over to Krishna and they got to me, and I said, my name is Janice Block, and I'm a spirit soul, and my mind right now is not healthy, I know I don't know, I don't understand it. But I know it's temporary, and I know I'm not going to be on medication for life, if at all. I happen to have my noni juice, but I believe in this, and I know God is greater than my illness. And after I said that, two women came up to me and were really upset because I kind of discounted their illness, and I was not intending to do that. And I tried to explain that, but I did have a man come up to me later who said to me, thank you. I wish I had such a great faith. So I guess what you said about using our brain to tax our brain for the right.
Yeah.
And then I want to take it one step further. I did approach, I received my first psychiatrist, which I had to see every day. and I walked in and I said to him, don't mess with my money and don't mess with my religion and we'll get along fine. He looked at me, said nothing, and he helped me. He really helped me.
That's great. I was kind of amazed once when, I think it was David Susskind, one of those talk shows on television where they address a group of people instead of just one, and all these were homeless people. And somehow the topic came around to God, and he asked them what their concept of God was, and one by one, somehow someone showed this to me on the video, I don't know how I saw it, because I'm not a TV watcher. And he said, and they, one by one, they were all saying that they believed in God, and that they thought that they were where they were. These are homeless people because they deserved it. And I was just amazed. I thought they'd be angry and bitter and hate God and everything else, but that happened. And I was just, I don't know what it means. I suppose that, you know, that saying that if Krishna really likes you, he takes everything away from you. It's Yahama. Anuganami. Yeah, anyway, there's some truth in that, I'm sure. Anything else?
Maharaj?
This lady has something to say. Go ahead. Good question. Did everyone hear what she said?
No.
She said, if you're always floundering in your duties, is it okay because you're always remembering Krishna? I think that was your question. Was that?
It's exactly okay, but you still consider that you're one point in the
house. That you're still focused on Krishna, even though, you know, other things are going a bit awry. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good, interesting concept. Yeah? Huh? Hit the nail on the head, says Radhamala. There's a verse that says, Devarshavu tapta nrinim pitrinanda kinkaramandari charajan sarvatmanaya sharanam sharanam mukundangrinishevayayava. Anyway, the idea is that if one is fully surrendered, fully, totally, 1,000% surrendered to Krishna, then obligations to the forefathers, to the family, to all living entities, to the great sages, to the domestic animals, are all automatically fulfilled. And there's another verse that says, yes, yes, bhakti-kinchana, sarvayar gunastratra samasate sura, that one who is surrendered to Krishna has all the good qualities of demigods, automatically. But it's interesting that in that very verse, which Prabhupada repeats in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, he lists all the 26 qualities of a devotee right afterwards, in the very next verse. Goodness, pridelessness, humility, quietness, doesn't argue with anyone, completely attached to Krishna, no sense to it. All 26 qualities are listed right after that verse. It's one after the other. And he, I guess it was like Martin Luther, he tacked his theses up to the wall. Well, Prabhupada tacked this up to the wall, 26 Second Avenue on the doorways. He said, try to develop all these 26 qualities if you can. And he had a list. So the idea is that unless one is fully surrendered, then we have so many responsibilities that we have to execute. We have to account for the money. Prabhupada used to make Shyamsundara account to the penny when he was teaching him accounting. I saw him when he was teaching with a Dwarkanath how to write. He was moving his hand how to make the letters. And he was very concerned about how people dressed, how they took care of things, how the temple was always clean, cleanliness next to godliness, and so on. So all those things are actually part of Krishna consciousness. And we're not on the level of Shukadeva Goswami. We're not on the level of Srinivas Acharya that, you know, it just doesn't matter. Krishna's going to take care of everything. It's all realized. Why do people read books? To understand how to produce books. Why do people read books when they get their computer? Why do they read the manual? Why do people study philosophy when they write books about philosophy? Why do people read about construction before they build a temple? Why do people go to lawyers who study all their lives about law? Why do they go to doctors when they're sick? So, in other words, we're very dependent upon knowledge, and sometimes we have to go out and get it ourselves. But that's not defying Krishna. That's not being one-pointed. Being one-pointed means that we know everything comes from Krishna. Krishna owns everything, and therefore we have to take care of everything. We're just custodians. We don't own anything, not even our own bodies. We have to take care of them because they belong to Krishna. So, if things are starting to flounder, it's not a good sign, generally. I mean, okay, there's exceptions, but generally, if I dress like a mess, if, you know, my colleagues don't like me at work, if my family distrusts me, if I don't care about the look of my place where I cook and all that, if my altar's a mess, I mean, these things, they all belong to Krishna. My very body belongs to Krishna. So I have to take care of those things. And part of being Krishna conscious, I mean, if we look at Prabhupada's life, he was very meticulous about everything, just the way he was, the way he spoke, the way he never really offended anybody. Everybody, because of the way he spoke. His words are so genteel. He would never say someone was having an affair. He was saying someone was implicated with somebody's wife. I mean, he just had a way of saying things that was so inoffensive, and just a way of taking care of everything so perfectly. He had a society. You know, he really got on my case once for selling a car because we didn't want to make payments, and I thought, well, better we just sort of cut our losses. But it had Hare Krishna written on it. It was a nice new car. And he really hammered me for that. So he was very meticulous. And sometimes people call it realized knowledge. Oh, yes, Krishna's going to tell you how to make a book. How do you end up with a product that looks like this? So Krishna's going to tell you how to do it. You don't have to learn. You don't have to read books to tell you how to do it. But if we do read books, that's Krishna. Krishna is the source of all knowledge. He says so in the Bhagavad Gita. Everything, knowledge, memory, forget, it all comes from me. So whatever we do it because it's Krishna's. Because whatever knowledge we go after, that's Krishna. It's all Krishna. So being one-pointed means to know that everything belongs to Krishna. It comes from Krishna. Even if we have to go after different things or do different things, like in our service, we have to do different things. But that's all. It's all Krishna. It's being one-pointed. It's seeing Krishna everywhere. It's seeing Krishna as the owner of everything. Bhoktaram Jagatavasam Sarvalokam. He's the owner. He says in Bhagavad Gita, I own everything, all the universes. What to speak of the tables and the chairs and the brinjals and the harmoniums that often go very awry in the temples. We don't take care of them. Yeah.
But doesn't it mean that when you're surrendered that you have those, you know, that you are Pagga and you have those 26 qualities?
If you're really surrendered, then you do have. Yeah. It doesn't mean that you don't have them when you're surrendered. It means you do have them in full when you're fully surrendered. But it doesn't mean that you don't try for them separately. Prabhupada thought them important enough to try for separately. And if you do come to the point of total surrender, then they are automatically there.
Could you explain perhaps a little bit more why Srila Prabhupada didn't want you to sell the car? I didn't quite understand.
Oh, okay. He didn't want me to sell the car because, first of all, it was a new car. And we were making payments, we just got a little behind, and it had the words Hare Krishna written on the back. And it was a good card, he wrote in it personally. And he liked the fact that hundreds of thousands of people maybe were seeing it every day, seeing the holy name of Krishna. He liked that. And he liked the fact that it was new. And So he was quite upset when he learned that we returned it. And it was also because it was a waste of money, because we had paid that company the money and they repossessed it and we didn't get anything back. So in his wisdom, Prabhupada saw that was a big mistake. So I learned the hard way. Okay.
With regard to what he was answering to this message here,
when
we are focused on Krishna as much as we can be at our level of real fight, and we are focused, but yet we do go a lot, and sometimes we don't do things, could it also be because in our sickness or in our process, we're going through purification and it makes us look like the addict story, things look a lot worse before they get better?
Sure.
So.
We're imperfect people, and we live in an imperfect world, and we're bound to make lots of mistakes on the path of Krishna consciousness. And we're very apt to forget Krishna completely, just getting absorbed in our own selves or our own activities. So along this path, as Prabhupada said, there are many thorns. We started one lecture by saying if you're walking through a thicket, you're going to get stuck with thorns. And they're going to stick to your clothes, and you're going to be what he called inconvenienced. In other words, you're going to get full of brambles and nettles or whatever. And I think it happened to a couple of us in Gita Nagari. We went out for a walk, and we didn't know there was nettles all over the place. And they were in there for a long time. So Krishna consciousness is like that. It can be very difficult. Yeah. Oh, and he used the example of the razor. He said that they used to shave before they had safety razors.